So, the essence of ethics, we've understood what is broadly meant by complete ethics. That is complete, everything, everybody, and especially monk and lay. So what we're seeing is that a Sangha is trying to make sense of the tradition that he's inherited, especially as he's started in a Hinayana school and then come into a Mahayana position, if you like. So he's trying to make sense of how all this fits together. And as we always do, he's making sense of it in the, what's the right word for it? The epistemological context that he has, given the tools that he's got, the means of understanding that he's got. He's got to start from the position that all the scriptures are literally what the Buddha said. That was not really seriously investigated until, I guess, the Western scholars started to get to grips with it, as far as I know, in the late 19th and especially the 20th century. Until that time, Buddhists would have thought of the text as being accurate records of what the Buddha taught. And they had to take account of the fact that there's a huge range of texts. Once you've accepted the Mahayana text, you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of sutras. And as I said yesterday, they often contradict each other. They present teachings that are quite different from each other and so on. So you've got to make some sort of sense of it all. Especially you've got to make some sense of the fact that that emerging at that time were two quite different views of what the goal of spiritual life was. Again, I'm necessarily going to be simplifying and therefore oversimplifying, partly because scholars still don't really understand fully the origins of the Mahayana, where it came from, how it evolved, for what reasons, and so forth. And even in the last 10 years, new sutras have been translated that give a greater insight into the slow build-up to the development of the Mahayana. So please accept that what I'm doing is telling a little bit of a just-so story, a way of accounting for what happened that is a much, much more complex process, or a way of describing what happened that's actually much more complex. You've got broadly two different ranges of schools, some who based themselves very much on the early suttas, which describe, and their Sanskrit equivalents, that describe the immediate context of the Buddha's life, and that we're familiar with in the Pali Canon. They were particularly concerned with preserving those texts, those sutras, and with codifying them, trying to analyse what they really meant and create out of them a systematic philosophy and psychology, the Abhidhamma, and trying to see how they played out in terms of a lived Buddhist life for monks and nuns in the Vinaya. So the emphasis was very much on those earlier texts. And if there was any emphasis on social welfare or whatever, it certainly wasn't at the front. Social welfare in the sense of concern with the life of others. There was a definite missionary attempt, and the Dhamma was definitely spread. It was very much on that sort of basis. The Mahayana refers more to the life aspiration of the Buddha, indeed the lifetime's aspiration of the Buddha, to become a full and perfect Buddha. And it was arguing that that's what we all should be doing, or could be doing. We could all be trying to become Buddhas. Of course, when I say the word the Mahayana thought, I'm sort of making it seem like it was a single person having an idea. At that time, there probably wasn't that much awareness of it as a separate school. It was a sort of trend within the overall community, and you could move seamlessly between these two different trends. But nonetheless, Asanga had bought very much the Bodhisattva ideal. He'd connected with it very, very strongly, and he's trying to give an account of the whole tradition, which ends with a, as it were, not a validation, but an expression of the Bodhisattva ideal, without denying all the schools that came before him. Quite a difficult job. And we see Buddhist teachers over and over again making the same attempt. In China, Zhe'i and the Tiantai school had their own way of looking at it. In Tibet, you got to increasingly the three yanas, Hinayana, Vajrayana, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and then the various gradations upwards from them, which included the tantras as coming from the Buddha. So every time they're inheriting what comes to them and trying to make sense of it as a whole. Right at the start, we can say that we are released from this terrible burden of history by our coming into Buddhism at a time when there's a historical sense, a sense of historical development. It seems as if up to that time, up until quite recently, people broadly thought that everything stays more or less the same. Kings change, but more or less everything's the same, if you see what I mean. But, well, we know that's not the case now. This has been studied more and more deeply, and especially in the 20th century, historiography has become a very subtle and rich understanding, given us a very subtle and rich understanding of historical processes and of what history itself does, history as interpretation. It's not a camera on the past, it's a recreation of the past from the point of view of the present. So we've got all that greater awareness of history. We've also got, thanks to the Christians, we've got a greater awareness of the nature of religious text. In the 19th and especially the 19th and 20th century, German scholars began to look at the Bible as a historical document. And they engaged in the two forms of criticism, the higher and the lower criticism. If I remember it rightly, the lower criticism is the looking at the text in its context, and the higher criticism is looking at the text for what it reveals about itself from within. I might have those two the wrong way around, being no theologian. But they began to see even the Christian text, which after all we were taught to believe dropped straight from the mouth of God, actually was a historical creation, and that the language in it itself has been interpreted and reinterpreted and reinterpreted. For instance, you know, we know that Jesus Christ was born of the Virgin Mary. Actually, the word that virgin translates now simply means a young woman. So this is what I've understood anyway. So the higher and lower criticism introduced a way of looking at texts that was, as it were, scientific. So it's only relatively recently that scholars have begun to look scientifically at Buddhist texts. And the process is far from complete. There's still a huge amount to be done, partly because of the vastness of the material, partly because so much has been lost, and partly because we know so little about the history of early Buddhist India. You know, for instance, in India, Ashoka, even the existence of Ashoka, had been completely lost. There are one or two Hindu texts which referred to the Emperor Ashoka, you know, arguably the greatest ancient Indian king, who was the one who launched Buddhism upon the world, really. But it was lost. The Buddha was lost. It was European scholars who rediscovered the holy sites in India by using Xuan Sung and Fa Tsien and so forth, these Chinese pilgrims. They used them as like guidebooks, and they were able to sort of follow their route and see, well, yes, this must be Bodh Gaya, this must be Saranath, this must be Shravasti, this must be Lumbini. It's extraordinary. It's completely lost. in India. Just interestingly enough, a few villages in Orissa, which, what's his name over there? Maitreya Bandhu has written a poem about this, inevitably. A few villages in India, which still, in Orissa, in eastern India, who regard themselves as Buddhists. And some of them are now our Mitras. They've been Buddhists through the ages, of course, increasingly Hinduized, but some of them are now involved with our movement. So in India, completely forgotten the Buddha. So it's really difficult to work out what all these texts mean and what went on. And the process is still going on. But we live in an age where we can look at our own tradition as a conditioned phenomenon, if you see what I mean. We're not afraid to look at it as a conditioned phenomenon. We're not afraid to apply modern scholarly techniques, machinery, to understanding the texts that we've got. We don't think that it belittles them. You know, I've told you quite a bit about the background to Asanga, but we've seen what he's got to say about the essence of ethics, which is extremely revelatory. So we're able, in our time, to both appreciate and revere and look with receptivity to these texts and to understand them as historically created phenomena. And Bhante really is coming very much from that sort of tradition. And he's been able all the time to take us back from the content and form of the text to the principles that underlie it. So the job that Asanga is trying to do here, again, Sangharakshita has done for us, especially in the 10 pillars of Buddhism. And you'll find, if you look at the 10 pillars of Buddhism, that many of the points that Asanga is making emerge in that text by saying, well, actually, we don't need to work out what the Bodhisattva means in relation to the monk and so forth. We just go back to the basic principles. And that's what I'm trying to do in taking through the text. I'm trying to see what in the text is, what the text was really saying, how it came about in a very superficial way, and try to see what relevance it has for us. So Asanga's trying to find a way of approaching ethics, Buddhist ethics, that applies to everybody, whether you're a lay person or a monk or a nun. Wherever you live, whatever you're doing, the Bodhisattva ethics apply to you. Of course, again, Asanga inherited this distinction between a Bodhisattva path and an Arahant path, the Shravaka Yana and the Bodhisattva Yana, as well as the Pratyeka Buddha Yana. And he took these literally, because that's what he inherited. What Bhante has done is say that, well, actually, it's not really quite like that. You cannot distinguish a Bodhisattva path from another sort of path, because any real progress on the path is a progress in selflessness. It's putting it very simply. If you're really making progress, you will become more selfless. If you don't become more selfless, you're not making progress. You're just refining your own egotism. Sometimes that's not a bad thing, but still it's not real progress. If you're really making progress, you're becoming more sensitive. Your ethical sense is awakening. You're becoming more and more free from self-attachment. You're more and more sort of identifying with the larger field of awareness rather than with the narrowly subjective dimension of awareness. Huh? So that we don't need to say, well, there is a real Arahant path, but that's supervened by a Bodhisattva path, and you can choose which one you want to go down. Shall I be an Arahant or shall I be a Bodhisattva? It's not like that. If you make any progress in any way at all, it will be a progress in selflessness. It's in the name, so to speak, because if insight means seeing through Atman, if it means Anatman, Anatta, Well, it means the freeing yourself from self. And freeing yourself from self doesn't mean you just become a big sort of selfless blob. It means that you become more open to others. Selflessness actually, or sorry, freedom from self actually means compassion. Anatta actually means compassion. It's compassion put, as it were, negatively. Not to put too fine a point upon it. If you really do see through self, you find that you're much more open to and sensitive to and merging, so to speak, with the world around you, with others around you. And that will intensify as you free yourself more and more from the delusion that there is a separate I. That's the way Bhante resolves this this sort of dichotomy that has really dominated Buddhism until this era. He says that it's not really true that there are separate paths, or if it seems that there are separate paths, if you pursue one that is not one leading to selflessness, it's not a path. You're just taking yourself and making it more refined and maybe a little less suffering. A sangha can't do that. He can't reject what he's inherited because it's in the scriptures. So he's sort of got to work with that and come to the same position in a different way. What we're going to look at now is his brilliant resolution of the problem in relation to ethics, which was really quite innovatory. It's not found before a sangha, and it then becomes the dominant motive often in a number of different teachers, their approach to ethics. So what he said is that there are three different dimensions of ethics. What's it say in the text itself? Furthermore, based upon the lay side and upon the monastic side, that is the two sides of ethical life, there are briefly three sorts: the ethics of the vow, the ethics of collecting wholesome factors, and the ethics of benefiting sentient beings. So the ethics of the vow, that's Sangvara Shila. The ethics of collecting wholesome factors, that's Kushala Dharma Parigraha Shila. And the ethics of benefiting living beings, Sattva Artha Kriya Shila, in the Sanskrit. So he said that an ethical life consists of these three aspects, and in a way they're not just aspects, they're also sequential. You have to develop the ethics of the vow before you can develop the ethics of collecting wholesome factors. You have to develop the ethics of collecting wholesome factors before you can develop the ethics of benefiting living beings. So what that then means is that as you make progress in your spiritual life, the nature of ethics changes. It's not that it changes, it unfolds in a deeper and deeper way. So let's put it briefly. Sangvara Shila, Sangvara, isn't that what we say? It's a word that means a binding, or sometimes a vow. It's something that you undertake in order to restrain yourself. Sometimes this is translated as the ethics of restraint. So, for instance, maybe you decide that you will become a vegetarian. You don't have a lot of feeling that this is wrong to eat meat or whatever. Maybe even you're doing it just because that's what everybody else is doing, or that's what the community generally recommends. No, this is true of a lot of people in India, where there's a complex cultural fact, but many people who became Buddhists thought of eating meat as progress, because it meant that they were making progress economically, if you see what I mean, because eating meat meant that you had enough money to do so. So coming from a very marginalized community, for them to eat meat was a sense of progress, and getting greater nourishment and so forth. So many people, when they come in contact with our movement, do become vegetarian. They do it because that's what we do, if you see what I mean. They don't do it because they have a deep insight into the fact that an animal is a living being. Maybe they can see that, but by and large, it's sort of just because that's what the culture does. And that's okay. We rather frown on that sort of thing, but it's fine. It's a good thing if there's a positive group that is influenced by positive values. I think we could do with a lot more of that in the West, actually, people doing what's good just because it's what people do. But we like to think that we do everything because we're hyper individuals. Us lot, terrible. So it starts, the ethical life starts by, to some extent, sort of doing things or not doing things just because you're taught that's what you don't do. Maybe not in a dishonest way, you know what I mean? You really genuinely think, oh, well, that's what Buddhists do. I want to be a Buddhist. That's what I'll do. I remember Bhante's a bit like that, isn't he? That he says that in his practice of Buddhism, he'd never thought about vegetarianism. And he spent his time, you know, he was taken to India by the army and never thought twice about not eating meat. Of course, probably wouldn't have had much chance in the British Army at that time. But when the war was over, he left the army. He was still in the army. He visited Singapore. And some Buddhist friends said to him, well, aren't you a vegetarian? And sort of explained why that was important. And I thought, oh yeah, I should be a vegetarian. So often it can be like that you take on ethical principles, not from a basis of a lot of immediate personal feeling, but because that's what the training suggests you do. And then because you're sincere about the training, you take on what the training suggests to you. It's much more common in a traditional society where people don't think so much in terms of they're not so proud of making their own decisions. They think much more in terms of working with what the culture is asking of them. But of course, restraint is not enough. It's very important because it prevents you from acting unskillfully and therefore building up negative mental states, building up lots of kalkrutya without the hriya and apatrapya, if you see what I mean. So you have a strong ethically dark mind, maybe minor darkness or maybe major darkness. But gradually, through your connection with the spiritual community, you take on those ethical principles. And I've seen that in India in a very, very vivid way. People who drink is very common amongst marginalized people everywhere. And I've seen people who have come on retreat with a strong and very unpleasant drinking history, often men, of course, it goes with domestic violence and so on. They'll go on retreat and they'll just stop, just like that. Because that's, you know, it's what the community doesn't do, if you see what I mean. So, Sangvarashila, and we can all take it on in that sort of way. Well, these are the precepts. Let's take them on. Let's practice them because they will help us to purify ourselves of unskillful mental states. But of course, Sangvarashila, prevention, giving up, is not enough. There needs to be an active effort to cultivate skillful mental states. If you like, the precepts as we recite them in Pali are not enough. They have to be paralleled with, accompanied by, the positive precepts. Panatipatave rimani sikapadam samadhiyami needs to be paralleled by, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my mind. My mind immediately goes to the Hindi, because that's the way I most commonly chant them. But you need both. So the with deeds of loving kindness is kushala dhamma parigraha shila. It's the shila that consists in the acquisition of, the development of, skillful mental states. Then, of course, that's not enough. You develop skillful mental states, which, of course, is very, very beneficial for you. As you develop skillful mental states, especially if you restrained yourself from unskillful action, as you develop skillful mental states, well, you definitely acquire some punya, some merit. Your mind is brighter, clearer, your actions are more smooth and harmonious, whilst you can't avoid all unpleasantness, as it were, coming to you, you can deal with it better and better. You're able to live much more in harmony with the world around you. So it's immediately beneficial for you personally. So what we've looked at so far is ethics as a means of personal benefit. In Buddhist tradition, this is known as for your immediate advantage, your worldly benefit, which is not looked down upon. It's a good thing, because if everybody looked to their real immediate benefit, the world would be a lot better place. If people lived by these two forms of ethics, well, we'd all get on much better and there'd be much less trouble between us. But it's not enough from a dhammic point of view. There needs to be a step beyond self, beyond your own benefit. As you begin to make progress, you begin to be aware that your progress is a progress in selflessness, and that a whole new set of ethical imperatives come upon you. You need to begin, in a phrase that's not used here, to take responsibility for the world around you. You need to have a sort of ethics of responsibility, where you recognize that it's not just a question of your own benefit, it's a question of the benefit of others. You begin to live the ethical life in order to benefit others. So ethics goes up a notch, goes up a major notch, and you begin to begin to think of how you act, not just in relationship to staying clear of unpleasant mental states, not just in terms of developing positive states so that you can be happy. You begin to think in terms of acting in such a way that the life of others is enhanced, in an absolutely immediate sense of those in the surroundings about you, and in a larger sense of, well, all beings. If you like, the Buddha is one who takes on the ethics of benefiting living beings on the highest possible level. He takes on the benefit of all living beings by cultivating a mind that can be reborn at a time when the Dhamma is gone and relaunching it. That's at least the sort of cosmic perspective, the highest cosmic perspective of the ethics of benefiting living beings. But we, as Dhamma practitioners, will come to, maybe already need to start working on, the level of taking responsibility for beings around us. I don't mean in a narrow and shallow sense, but of working for the benefit of others, so that our lives, our ethical practice, is in relation to others. Of course, that benefits them, but it also benefits us, because through undertaking that ethics of benefiting living beings, we lessen and lessen and lessen our own self-attachment. So the ethics of benefiting living beings becomes, in effect, a parallel to insight practice. Insight practice deals with a selfhood by looking at its impossibility, if you like, by recognizing that it cannot be, there cannot be an independent self. It works on the attachment within us. But as well as doing that, we need to be working on the ethics that go with it. There's an ethics of insight, if you like. That ethics of insight is an increasing a living of one's life to benefit others. Not in a shallow and, I'm a saint, martyred saint sort of thing, but as an authentic effort to work out the Dhamma in relationship to others. And this, of course, is a very much principle underlying our own movement and our own order, that we enter into our into this movement with the idea that we're coming into a deeper and stronger relationship with our brothers and sisters, and that we are working increasingly together to benefit the world, by especially by bringing the Dhamma more and more into this suffering realm, and in other ways too. So that the text shows us how these different dimensions of ethics fit together. So yes, the monk and the nun on the one hand, and the lay people on the other, are practicing sangvaraśīla. They're practicing the ethics of restraint by following their own particular codes of conduct. But the ethics that the pratimoksha, the vinaya, that the monks and nuns follow, helps them to restrain themselves. And, you know, if you really do it properly in the right context, it does so in a big way. If you're living a lay life, you're trying to practice the five precepts, maybe later the 10 precepts, more and more punctiliously, more and more deeply. It's not so easy to have a sort of codified way of life for a lay person, but you're trying to work out your life so it supports an innocent life. It's very interesting. The word shila in Sanskrit and Pali doesn't just mean ethics in our normal sense. It doesn't just mean conduct in the sense of doing wrong or doing good. It also has a connotation of it's sometimes translated as manners or even etiquette. It's not just refraining from certain actions, it's trying to take on certain behaviour that is not offensive to others. You know, my mother shouted at me, "Don't eat with your mouth full! Don't talk with your mouth full!" Well, that in a way is shila, if you see what I mean, because it's not very pleasant to see the cement mixer full. So you learn sort of certain, you know, and of course they're conventional. Some societies have different attitudes to these things. It took me a while to get round the hearty belch in India. But the manners is included in ethics. You take on certain sort of ways of behaving, which shouldn't be prissy and sort of pseudo-gentrified or whatever, but a smooth and pleasant way of interacting with others that doesn't cause offence and that is decorous, you might say, aesthetically pleasing, or at least not aesthetically unpleasing. So, yeah, just expanding the notion of ethics is important in this way. So the monks and nuns and the lay people try to build lives that are innocent and where they definitely undertake to refrain from doing certain things because those things are unskillful in various ways, harm others or harm self or whatever. And that's a really important dimension of ethics, which we all need to be engaging with. But the ethics of restraint applies to everybody, but in different ways, in different contexts. In the modern West, there are so many different kinds of lifestyle that you'd have to have almost a different ethics for every person, if you see what I mean, ethics of restraint for every person, broadly fitting under the categories of the 5 and 10 precepts. But you'd have to work out how it worked in your particular context. So, for instance, if you live in a community in Tri Ratna, the community will have its own customary behaviour, which allows everybody to live together in harmony, and where who's going to do the washing up, and whose cooking night it is, how you eat together. For instance, communities I've lived in, often you don't start until everybody's present. That's an etiquette, but it helps to create harmony. And, you know, maybe sometimes there's silence while people are eating. So there's an ethics of restraint, a customary restraint that enables a positive shared life. And it'll be the same in families. There's sort of unwritten rules, unwritten boundaries. Some of them not so rational, but quite a lot of them are sensible, which enable the family to function well. Or all sorts of other complex arrangements we all have nowadays. It's not so simple as it used to be. My Indian friends' minds boggle when they hear what arrangements we have. So, yes, we need a there's an ethics of restraint in that sense. But then we need to be... there needs to be an active work to develop positive mental states. We do the metta bhavana. We do puja. We do communication exercises to learn better the principles of deeper communication. We develop kalyanamitrata, friendship, in which we come into deeper and more positive relations with each other. We develop the other brahmaviharas, karuna, mudita, and upeksha, so that we're really actively cultivating skillful mental states. We're looking at our behaviour not just from the point of view of what we don't do, but of what we do do that is positive. So we need to build a life that has a positive cultivation within it of skillful mental states. But it needs to go further than that. And this is where it gets really interesting. And it's what I'm going to be concentrating on for the next 2 days. We need to be developing an awareness of the ways in which we can help other living beings. As Buddhists, how can we help other living beings? It's not just becoming a social worker, as it were, which may not be a bad thing if it's done in the right spirit. It may be part of it if it's done in the right spirit. It's not just that. It's about approaching others with a certain attitude, a certain spirit, and having certain aims and objectives for them, which are fundamentally, according to the text, to place them from a less skillful in a more skillful mental state. Your fundamental purpose in Sattva Artha Kriya Shila, in the ethics of benefiting living beings, is to take living beings and help them to achieve a better mental state, a better, more ethical, more skillful mental state. The text itself goes into each of these in a certain amount of detail. It goes into the ethics of restraint. Actually, interestingly enough, a lot to do with practice of meditation, interestingly, and with the three prajñas, suttamaya, shrutamaya prajña, chintamaya prajña, and bhavanamaya prajña. So it goes into the active practice of the Dhamma. So applying the sangvara of practice, if you see what I mean. But I'm not going to look at that. I'm not going to go through that in detail. So what I want to concentrate on is the last. It talks quite a bit about the developing skillful mental states, mainly in terms of a version of the paramitas, not the six paramitas, but another version of the paramitas. It goes into that in quite a bit of detail, ways in which you cultivate skillful mental states. Again, one could spend a lot of time pursuing that, but what I want to particularly concentrate on is the last part of the text, which is concerned with the 11 modes for practicing Sattva Artha Kriya Shila, the ethics of benefiting living beings. Because I think this is where the greatest new material is to be found, and which had a very strong formative effect upon the whole understanding of the Bodhisattva's life, and that lies in the background of the precepts that Bhante took from Dada Rinpoche. So from now on, I'm going to focus on those 11 modes. I'll start Tomorrow morning you'll be relieved to hear. I won't go through them all now. But take for granted that we kind of got a broad idea of what we mean by sangvarashila, doing things that stop you from doing unskillful things, taking on precepts that stop you from doing unskillful things. You know, those little vows that you make to yourself, I will not do this, because you know it's just messes you up and not very good for others too. I hope you've all got your own private list of things that you're sort of concentrating on not doing because they're not very good, you know, like slagging other people off, which is one of the best pastimes we can have, isn't it, as we cultivate this art of grumbling and groaning about other people. The British are particularly keen on it. But, you know, you just decide, I'm not going to speak badly about other people, for instance, to name a personal one. So you've got those sort of ethics of restraint. You've got the precepts. You're trying to apply them to yourself, and hopefully trying to do it more and more assiduously. Then you've got your ways of cultivating positive mental states, especially through metta-bhavana, our primary mode, and through devotion, which is an extremely important way of cultivating skillful attitudes, which we need to do a lot more of, because especially in much of the modern West, the attitude of reverence is very complex for us. Again, something I really notice with my Indian friends, they're completely unashamed about reverence. It's not a problem for them. Sometimes to a fault, but it's not a problem for them. Whereas we're very suspicious of our own reverence. We're very suspicious of looking up to anything. We easily feel we need to debunk and undermine. But you know, many cultures in the world don't have that. It's something that's developed probably since the major collapse of Christianity, since the Protestant Reformation, and then the growth of a scientific perspective on the world, and especially from our deep experience in the 20th century of how evil human beings can be. We've become very cynical. Look at the way we think of our politicians. So we need to cultivate a much stronger sense of reverence. And of course, it has to be intelligent reverence, but often better to have a foolish reverence than no reverence at all. At least a foolish reverence can become more subtle and more intelligent. So we need to do a lot more to cultivate skillful mental states for our own benefit and as a basis for something more. So I'm going to take all that for granted. I'm sure you've been well trained at the LBC what those mean, even if not in those terms. I'm sure that everybody is here. There are all mitras, at least. And I'm sure that you've you know, got some practice in both these fields of ethics. And if you haven't, think about it and go a bit further, go a bit deeper. But what I want to look at is how the ethics of responsibility comes into the picture. That's the way I think of it. This taking responsibility for something more than your own happiness, your own success and pleasure. How does that come into play? It comes into play through these 11 modes, which we'll begin to encounter tomorrow morning. And we'll look at over the next 2 days. It's a little bit difficult because the 11 modes are dealt with 3 times in the text, and each time they're dealt with in slightly different categories. I've not yet found a scholar who divides them up in exactly the same way. So I say that so that you can excuse me if you don't find it meets with your interpretation of the text. But I will divide them up roughly into 11 portions, and we'll look at each one and go into them in principle and then maybe a little bit in practice. And each of you can be thinking about how you might be engaging with those. You probably are to some extent, but how might you engage with them more? And some of them are really interesting, some of them even a little bit shocking. So prepare to be shocked. So I'm going to release you now. That's quite enough for another day. I am aware this is quite heavy going, as it were, for you to take in all of this, but I'm interested to see how it works at the end of it, just a sort of complete exposition of at least part of a text and see how much you can work with it. Clearly, you've got to do the work elsewhere, if you see what I mean. I'm giving you material, and some of that material, no doubt, will sink in. Some of it will relate to you. Then you've got to do the work to activate it, and no doubt discussion will help that. So enough for today. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow morning and encountering the ethics of responsibility for all living beings.